Testing 1, 2, 3. 4, 5, 6. Testing 1, 2, 3. 4, 5, 6. Testing 1, 2, 3. 4, 5, 6.
Okay. All right. Well, I don't know who all is going to be here, so I'm Clyde Pierce from the Department of Health and Social Services, and played a significant role in preparing these proposed regulations. They are proposed. They're not a fact. And so to start the meeting, I'm going to just briefly go over this announcement, which I hope all of you received, or at least you're aware of, or you probably wouldn't be here. And basically what it's saying is that we propose new regulations at the Department of Health and Social Services. There are existing regulations, but they don't address certain areas of radiation control. And the existing regulations also have a large part of them, almost half, that deals with radioactive materials. And radioactive materials now are handled exclusively by the federal government, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So a big part of the changes is to eliminate all references to radioactive materials. And so that's one part of it. The other part is to include some detailed information on aspects of radiation control that are not addressed currently. So we have radiation control regulations currently that say where you have to put up a sign when you have personnel monitoring required, what exposure limits are for occupational exposure, and that sort of thing. But and that applies to CT and radiation therapy and bone densitometry, et cetera. But we don't have anything specifically about radiation therapy. We have no regulations about, that are specifically radiation therapy, or CT, or bone densitometry, or MRI. And we have no regulations at all about suntanning, which is a completely different area, but it is within the authority and responsibility as given by the statutes for it to be regulated. And because of a number of trends that are going on nationwide, we felt the need to update our regulations to make it more synchronous with other states. Unfortunately, it has been 2 years since these were written, and due to some process delays, we're just now getting to it. So that means that these are not the most up-to-date, but we didn't want to make any more substantive changes and then delay the process even more. So we're ready to move ahead once we have public comment. And, of course, we have to have public comment because you may have a very different perspective than what's presented here, and it's important to get all comment. And I would say, is anyone here involved with cardiology? Okay.
And radiology.
And radiology, yeah. I've had a little bit of concern, and I actually was going to call a particular cardiologist this morning and didn't have a chance. One of the changes is to lower the occupational exposure limits. These are the 50 millisieverts per year is consistent with what is present in most states right now. It's higher than what the IAEA and the ICRU have been proposing for years, and it's higher than the standard in Europe. And based on film badge report, personnel monitoring badge reports, we think that we can easily accomplish that, but cardiology is a concern, and so I've been a little bit surprised. I have not heard anything, and maybe that's a good sign about whether lowering the occupational limits for cardiology would be a problem. So we want to especially look at that. So basically, those are the regulations we want to change. One of the things that's changing also is the fees will go up. There will be an initial fee that is higher than the annual renewal. Anyone who is currently registered is already registered, and so they would not encumber an initial rate. They would have the lower rate. And then there's the idea of a permit for operators, and I can get into that more in a little while, but we think that's pretty important also. And so with that, I would like to know if there's anyone who has comments or questions related to the regulations. Yes, sir.
Yeah, the,
would you mind identifying yourself?
Oh, Scott Hazelbaker, here at Corrective Radiology.
Yes.
So the permit thing, I'm curious about for MRI. Sounds like
yes.
There's a special permit for MRI. And one of the questions is, if the technologist ART registered, do they need a permit to operate MRI? But if there's going to be a separate operating permit for MRI, what is that? What's the training?
Well, if they have met the standards of the American Registry of Radiology Technologists, or an equivalent certification, which would basically state licenses in other states. 39 states license technologists, for example, and those are comparable. So those would meet that same standard. And also, if they were registered by certain they're national registries, but they have comparable standards to the U.S. So, for example, if you are a registered tech in Canada or in England or in Australia, their registry would be accepted as equivalent to the ART, even though they don't have ART or state licensure.
Okay, so if they're registered in nuclear medicine in that profession, can they operate
in MRI? Yeah, this is not licensure by any means.
Oh, okay.
And so it's not that finely broken down. There are several ways that this falls short of licensure. Right.
As opposed to, now, why would we want to do that? What's the purpose for wanting to
propose that? Well, it goes along with this whole idea of keeping exposures as low as possible. And if we are getting exposed beyond a certain level, then we have a concern about are there ways that we can lower that? And if we were to change our occupational limits to what has become an international standard, then we would be consistent with the rest of the world.
And is that almost like 50% lower?
It's a little less than 50% lower.
Okay.
And most badges, if you come, nuclear medicine or radiation therapy or ordinary radiography, those are typical badges are 10 to 20 MR a month, which is way below even the proposed standard. My one concern is this going to hamper cardiac work? Is that going to be impractical or not? I have to have feedback from the cardiology people to know that. And so far, I haven't had any, so I'm a little bit.
It sounds like it's going to be a pretty hard measure for cardiologists.
It might be, and that's the feedback we need to know if that's the case.
Yeah, I mean that's the feedback that I'm receiving currently. Able to make, the national standards as opposed to the international standard, I think you're going to have an issue with keeping their dose low. And then, is that something that nationally is being accepted? Are we accepting the international standard?
I'm sorry, I have a message here that if you're testifying, you should sit at the microphone.
Oh, okay.
sorry about that.
There you go. Is it on? Okay.
All right.
Good.
I hope you've all been able to hear. Okay.
That's probably for recording, I imagine.
All right.
Okay. So, yeah, then the question being is that something that's being accepted nationally is going to this international standard?
It's in the process. Other states are also considering that at this time.
Okay.
So, I'm a member of an organization called CRCPD, which is a Conference on Radiation Control Program Directors. And we meet once a year and discuss things on a national level. So, for example, if we propose certain regulations in Alaska, are these consistent with the rest of the country?
Right.
And so that's what we look at. And at this point, there are several states that are considering this.
Okay. So then when does that decision could be made, just to make sure that we have our cardiologists on board, director of cardiology?
Well, I hope they're talking about it now, and if it's a concern that they you can comment by email or letter or fax still. I mean, today is not the only time. You have until January 15th.
Okay.
So
right now it is a concern for PAMC, for our cardiologists.
Okay.
Radiologists.
Well, they should definitely
definitely
express that. And January 15th is the deadline for testimony or comment. Then we have to look at all of these comments and see if any of them are substantive enough that we need to rethink and change what the proposal says, and it may be that we would not change the occupational limits at all. Or if we do make substantial changes from what's there, that would be different from what we have now and different from what's in here, and they're substantial, then we would have to perhaps do a major rewrite, and then this would have to go out to public comment again.
Okay.
So as far as when these are implemented, it depends on what happens during this next month.
Okay. All righty, Don,
Did you want to come through?
So I'm Don Allison, the supervisor of nuclear medicine. I understand that we're pulling all of the regulations associated with radioactive material or the handling of radioactive material out.
Correct.
But now you're imposing radiation limits that kind of cross the boundaries, because if we're saying the NRC is governing what radioactive material is handling,
right,
do we fall under the state regulations for radiation exposure, or are we still under the federal guidelines?
You would have to fall under the federal guidelines.
So
we would have no basis for saying that you exceeded a limit if the NRC says that you're under the NRC and they say that it's within the limit.
Okay, so now we're splitting hairs, because half of radiology is going to be under the 2,000 millirem limit, and
right,
we have nuclear medicine techs, which really don't need the 5,000 that are following under the federal.
Right.
We do have policies at major hospitals that are required by federal law to create an ALARA program, which is to try to achieve as low as reasonably permissible radiation exposure, and Providence Hospital has theirs at one-tenth of the federal legal limit, so we're only looking at 500 millirem a year.
Right.
I understand that, but there are several instances, both for cardiologists and for interventional radiologists, where we're having problems keeping them below even 3,000 a year. So this is going to be technically hard for us to do.
Right.
So that's the specifics that I wanted to bring out to that. And then, as you're saying, we're going to split hairs now. We're taking nuclear medicine, which is a byproduct component, and we're still falling under federal limits. I also looked the other day associated with the 2,000 millirem limit, and I see no indication that the federal government is going that way currently.
Currently.
I would as soon just see everybody stay under the federal limits as they are proposed right now, and then if they mandate a different rule, then we can go to that. But I do understand that we're trying to make it as reasonably small as possible.
Right, right.
And that's what the ALARA program is for.
Right. Well, that's very, very good, very helpful. Thank you. Anyone else have?
Sure.
Yes.
My name's Matt Halala, and I'm a podiatric surgeon, foot and ankle surgeon in town. And my question pertains to the broader application of X-ray as it pertains to the private small practice, and as it has been for like the last 60 years in my profession as a podiatrist. We've traditionally take our own X-rays with a small, very low dose, single tube X-ray unit with, and also dentistry. I've had some phone call conversations with physicians in more remote areas of Alaska, and the concern is that that we're going to get folded into some of these larger regulatory initiatives that might have on their radar primarily, larger dose modalities.
Yes.
Such as the concept that everyone that has any form of X-ray diagnostic tool in their office has to have a certified X-ray technologist as the one pushing the button. And that's not been the standard in many of our subspecialties,
mm-hmm.
And it creates some logistic difficulties, especially for rural Alaska, where you might have a clinic with nurse practitioners and PAs, and you're lucky to have those full-time out there to begin with, where maybe they twist their ankle, and they're not sure, well, do I need to go to Anchorage? Is this a bad ankle sprain? Well, we're not sure. We had an X-ray tech here 6 months ago, but they're not here now, so we got to fly you to Anchorage to get an X-ray, because if it needs surgery, it should be done within 2 weeks. So these are logistical fears of ours. I guess the question is the thrust of these regulations to encompass all aspects of in-office, low-dose X-ray modalities in that regard?
Well, several comments. First, dentistry is not included in this. The small clinics are. The regulations do not say you have to have a certified technologist for those small clinics. there is a provision in the proposed regulations for a waiver for them.
Oh, okay. I don't think we saw that.
Okay. Let me...
Now, was it the size of the clinic, or was it the modality being utilized as the criteria for an exemption? Was it...
It's the type of procedures performed. The waiver option is if you're doing mainly extremities and chest,
right,
and that kind of thing.
Just yeah, right.
Right, right. So there is a provision for that for the smaller clinics in that regard. The other thing is that I noticed you mentioned that that's what they've been doing for 60 years. One of the big things in here, in fact, a lot of people don't even seem to realize that in the current regulations, one of the things that every facility is required to do is monitor for exposure creep. The new technology has the capability of lowering exposure to patients considerably. However, on a nationwide basis, we have seen constantly increasing exposures to patients, and they call it exposure creep, sometimes dose creep. And so there is a provision that you're to monitor that because the patient doesn't know, and the operator, if they really don't have a radiology background, may not realize they're giving a patient four or five times the dose necessary.
So this falls under the yearly metrics and calibration testing for our units? Is that what you're saying?
It could be evaluated that way. Let me, and I do have a write-up on some ways of doing that.
I mean, I think that's probably how it's monitored out in clinics now, is just that yearly testing to make sure they're testing for scatter, testing your collimation technologies are working properly and all these things.
Well, yeah, that's part of the calibration to make sure the machine is operating correctly. But the machine can be operating correctly, and that's one of the things about all of this is the machines are generally not the problem. When I do inspections, I rarely find problems with the machines, but it's how they're used. And so, and one of the things I do in small clinics that has been very revealing is to, let's say I came to a clinic that you own, and I would have the operator then simulate doing a chest X-ray on me and do everything except push the button. But I want to observe how they set me up, how they adjust the collimator, because surprisingly how people don't adjust the collimator. It's wide open. My whole body is being sprayed. And I ask them about that, and the usual reason is, well, I don't want to miss anything. Well, you know, the image receptor is a certain size. It doesn't matter how big the collimator is. You're not going to get any bigger picture. And then I look at the technique that they've selected, and I look at their technique chart, and, you know, often they're like the chart came out of a book and has nothing to do with this system. So we do have concerns about the radiation exposure in the
small
clinic.
Well, I think that answers the question. I really didn't know that there was any kind of exemption consideration for small, you know, in the range of 1 to 5 microsievert type exposure units. You know, that's kind of the world we live in. As your typical abdominal CT is like 7,000 versus.
Oh, right,
like,
right.
And then now the other thing I'd like to point out. There's a new technology that we just acquired that has traditionally been for head and neck, and it was cone beam CT, head and neck CT units for like the oral surgeons, the ENT physicians. Also incredibly low exposure in the range of 3 to 9 microsieverts versus an institutional grade CT is, again, 5,000 to 7,000. They took that same unit, turned it upside down, made it a little bit larger for weight-bearing foot and ankle. And so we've got one of about 11 in the world. It was featured on the Today Show in Britain at the Royal Hospital
with
new technology. So this is a CT unit, but it's cone beam CT. And it's also 5 microsievert exposure. And we're concerned that if that technology isn't spoken of, that we will get looped into the CT. You know, like you have to have a certified technology, all these things that might not be so practical for the private practice that has this safer, lower radiation exposure version of CT. I know that one of the ENT practices that couldn't be here today also expressed some, the ear, nose, throat practice, concern about their cone beam unit. And
we know that, of course, again, we don't regulate dentists, but the cone beam CT in dentistry is a significantly higher dose than plain film periapical study. But it's not the same as a full-scale CT would be used in a hospital.
Right. We've got some literature that I could drop off in regards to the cone beam that you may be seeing more about.
Mm-hmm.
That basically it's little more than the daily ambient radiation from walking around town.
Mm-hmm.
From a full foot and ankle study. So, putting.
Does that include scatter information?
Yeah, it does. So.
Okay.
And of course, to place this, we had to be consistent with all of the other standards and the physicists drawing up exactly where it could be in the office and
right.
The measurements and the yearly calibration and all this stuff. And it's as simple as, you know, hitting a button and there's no collimation required. So it's even simpler than your old standard X-ray.
Right.
So
right.
This is the concern, is that the technology is rapidly accelerating away from our policies and procedures. And I think the technology
The
technologies are becoming cheaper, easier to use, and safer, to the point where more and more people are going to have access to this technology in their offices and in sparsely populated areas, I think. And
well, yes, and I agree with that, other than it's theoretically safer because we're seeing more biological effects now than we have since 1970, since the invention of the CT scanner. The biological injuries have jumped up considerably. They were on a downward trend for
and
70
but
years.
They're related to not your tiny dose diagnostic stuff. I mean, there's no been no formal correlation with low dose diagnostic radiography and disease. Actually, there's been no formal definitive correlation. In the literature, I just did a recent search, and that's the definitive discussion there. So that's our concern. For
so
the
you're suggesting an exemption that has to do with the radiation output of the device.
I think so, because that directs to accumulated dose in the human, which is presumptively what would give rise to disease. So that's what I'm suggesting.
Well, we already have that in a different way. I mean, if you buy an ordinary radiographic unit and install it, you can just start using it. We don't need to come in and inspect you first. But if it has an exposure rate greater than the high dose rate of a fluoroscopic device, which would be like a linear accelerator or high dose rate fluoro, then it needs to be approved before you can start seeing patients.
So I just wanted to make sure that was a part of the discussion.
Yes.
That we were
going to
just forgotten
it.
About. Like,
I appreciate that.
Guess what? You can't hit the button anymore, and we've got to find some, you know, shut it all down and all this all around the states.
Right.
Okay.
Well, we're concerned about radiation safety, and as long as we meet that, we can certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you for testifying. All right. We have a call. We have a caller on the line. Okay.
Hi. This is Donna Turner down in Ketchikan, Alaska.
Yes.
And I'm calling in reference to the proposed tanning salon regulations that are on the agenda. And I've been in the business for 28 years. And the FDA has already stated and put in their rules and regs that all the way from the manufacturers, the tanning industry has had to follow these rules. A lot of these rules that you're putting in or want to put in are just an overlap of the existing federal standards and regs. And I'm really concerned mostly in the fact that when it comes down to the fact of us getting our permits, that we're going to need to buy, and also all the tanning bed fees that need to go in, that us and our smaller communities of Alaska that have populations that are nowhere near Anchorage and Fairbanks, that we're going to be required to pay the same amount of fees for our shop permits as the larger ones do. This puts a great financial burden on an industry here in the Southeast. We're already suffering financially, you know, over the last almost two decades now with reduction of our populations, our industries that have had to, you know, they've been shut down, our pulp mills, all of, you know, the logging industry, the fishing industry is down. Most of our people don't make big wages, you know, they make minimum wages and maybe a little bit above. And we've already have imposed upon us from the FDA and the IRS the 10% federal tanning tax. And I think that this is going to put too much of a burden on us. As far as, you know, I've done a lot of research through my years and everything, and I just really kind of oppose the tanning beds being put in with CT scans and normal x-rays. As we all know, with CTs, they put out, you know, like 23 times what a chest x-ray will. And I just like to know exactly if you guys are going to consider that with our permit fees, are you going to base that on our annual income?
Okay. The fee that's shown in the proposed regulations is a set amount that doesn't take into account the annual income of any business. It would be applicable across the board. And I do agree with you on the fact that this is an overlap over FDA requirements. And I understand that you are you participate in the National Tanning Training Institute and other national entities that do set they're like an industry standard, but they have no force of law. So in Alaska, to implement these, we're not talking about doing anything more than what is already established as a national standard. There are two problems with the national standard. Tanning facilities are not inspected by the federal government here, and we do need to keep track of them. I have visited some to evaluate the situation, and I commend you that you have followed that particular standard, but not all of them do, and some of the conditions I've seen were pretty appalling. And the FDA has been tightening up more and more on how tanning beds are used because of the association with skin cancer and the death rate, rising death rate from skin cancer. So this is totally consistent with the FDA. It is a duplication of the federal, but we do need that here. And I understand your main concern has to do with the fees, given that you're a relatively low-income business. And so we need to take a good look at that again. In the light of the fees.
Yes, there are many small little places like here in Ketchikan. We've got hair salons that have one unit, gyms that have one unit, you know, two units. I only have five units. I only have five little units, and I talked to one gentleman who has 50 units. You know, and he's making more money in 3 to 4 days than any of us small little towns can make in a month or better. Some days we don't see very many people. We don't even see that many when we're so-called busy compared. And I know, and I'm speaking for a lot of our small little places. I'm speaking on their behalf as, you know, it's going to end up making a lot of these small businesses either close, because if it's going to be so high, we can't afford it. We have a lot of other things that we do, you know, like our insurance is run because we're in the state of Alaska, not because we're down south. They do have higher insurance rates up here, and that's a lot for a small business to have to absorb on top of it. I think that, you know, when it comes to the certification and stuff, you know, like for me, I've been certified long before it was ever required. When it first came about, I went in and got certified. Well, I train every single person that helps me, which is usually my daughter, and I take every individual person and go through and I talk to them. And yes, I do have high standards, and I do understand. The thing of it is right now, you know, down here in the small communities, the DEC is very low staffed. They already have a lot of strain on them right now trying to go around and check everything that they have on their board now. So how are you guys going to cover the extra manpower that's going to be needed in smaller communities? Our people have to fly out to other areas or take the ferry to other areas to do other towns. And this financially on the state of Alaska is going to increase. I think that maybe you might want to maybe think about maybe implementing something along the way that maybe the DEC could pick one person in each community to maybe go and inspect and everything. Because a lot of us in the tanning industry, we're concerned, too, about everything. We're concerned about how cleanly we are, whether or not people are having to fill out their paperwork and get skin typed and stuff. I mean, I myself down here in Ketchikan would be willing to even, you know, cross over and help whoever I needed to help to bring their places up to what you guys would want as a standard. But I just don't think that the DEC is going to be able to handle the all the places that they're going to have to go and do and everything. And, yes, of course, you know, I believe in trying to educate my client to the best of my ability, which is very high, to understand everything about the tanning, the tanning process, what it does, how far it goes. I'm at, you know, don't do this. Everything's mandatory in my salon. It's mandatory that they get skin tight, that they sign any paperwork that they need to do, any medications that they do. I you know, walk through with them. I tell them. I insure them. I actually even have goggles there, you know, that I make sure it's mandatory in my salon. I tell them, if you don't want to do that, then, hey, then you're not going to do it in my salon. You're not going to be here in my salon tanning. And I know that. Have you guys ever come up to the exact amount of radiation that the tanning that it actually puts out?
Well, we have information on select tanning bed in terms of their output and how the light affects that, the selection of lights, the age of the lamps. In fact, there are quite a few variables in relation to tanning bed output. I need to correct a couple of things. This is not DEC. This is the Department of Health and Social Services. The DEC inspecting.
Well, the DEC signed on to these regs. What I'm saying, I know that you will follow. I'll be sending up all my stuff, and you'll send a copy off to DEC from what the paperwork says.
Well, the DEC, basically, what they are doing is repealing aspects of the existing regulation that relate to radioactive materials. At the same time that we are, because those have been shared responsibilities in the past. The second thing is, you're talking about 50 beds versus one bed. The registration fee is per bed, so a facility with one bed would certainly not be paying the same as a facility with 50 beds.
Okay,
and then your question about how they would be inspected, that's part of the reason that the fees have not been raised in 25 years when gas was a dollar a gallon, and so this would theoretically generate sufficient income that we really do need a second person inspecting and fully plan to do that so that we would have the staffing. And I appreciate your input.
Okay, well, then there's a little bit. Could I, on the fees and stuff, it says that we will need to have a certification on the shop, and we have to register and pay a fee on the beds, was my understanding on the reading of this. When I went into the regulations, I have a copy of the regulations here. And it stated here that there was, that it was going to be a shop. The shop's going to have a certificate.
Well, the certificate is issued when you register the device. You register one device, 10 devices, 100 devices. When you register, you get a certificate. That's not a totally separate thing, not an additional fee.
Okay, so we have to register all of our beds. Okay, my understanding on this when I was reading through it was that we'd have a shop, we'd have to have a permit, you know, like my shop, I have my shop permit, you know, for the rest of my shop, you know, through
no.
the state. I'm a licensed shop, you know, for my other thing. So then we're not going to have a, let's see. Okay, so let's see. Have you guys figured out how much our shop permits are going to run? Have you guys set a dollar amount on that?
Do you have a copy of the draft, the November 20th, 2013 draft on page 140, where it lists the proposed fees? There's no special, there's no fee based on the shop. It's based on the registration of a device.
So, yeah, so that's what I mean. I'm at, you're saying that the registration of the device, then the guy who has 50, he has to pay a registration fee on every single bed, right?
That's correct. Now,
okay, so there's not going to be an additional shop
no,
permit.
No, there's
too.
Not.
Okay, I misread that or misunderstood that. I still kind of I feel that, you know, we shouldn't be in with CT scans. I mean, they're pretty hefty as far as all the radiation amounts on, like with the gentleman before me. I'm at 7,000. I don't think that a tanning bed puts out 7,000.
No, it's a different kind of radiation. It's not related to CT at all in the regulations.
Uh-huh. But we're going to be bunched in the same group, though, right? Basically.
Only in terms of all of the regulations having to do with regulating radiation of some form or another.
Okay. Now, when it comes to us having to certify all the employees, what happens when they're, you know, every time that you have to go in and train an employee, it's $100 at least for them to go through it. So this is not an industry that a lot of, you don't get workers that stay a long time in them. You know what I mean? When you hire
How do you train your employees now? Do you use the NTTI courses?
I train them myself because I've done it, and I've only got my daughter. I have my daughter helping me and stuff like that. But what about all the other ones that have it, and they have to go in and they have to pay, say they pay $100 to train Mary, and 2 weeks later she quits and then Sarah comes on. Then they have to pay another $100 to have that person trained, and then that person quits after a month. And then they have to train another person. That's going to put a lot of financial burden onto a smaller revenue, and also the larger revenue, for that matter, as far as having to keep paying for a training when it should be able to, like if the owner has certification and they train their, you know, their own under their certification and their knowledge. I have all my paperwork and stuff from when I took mine. My two, actually, I'm double certified. So that's not going to be sufficient as part of a training like it would be in a lot of other industries?
Well, that sounds like a business opportunity to conduct training for all of those people. NTTI training.
But you're still going to have to do it through NTTI or SmartTAM.
And that training would meet the standard. Completely done on a line, and is there even a fee for that?
$100.
Okay.
It's $100 every time you go on and you take that test for somebody. It's $100. It might even have gone up since I did it. I mean, I took mine in 2001, and my fee was $100 for that. And when I went down to the tanning convention, and it was $125 for me to take my second one because I wanted to have two different trainings just to make sure. That's me. But, yes, it is. It's a financial burden. So then if somebody has 10 employees that they've trained and they've quit, they've spent $1,000 in a year, and they still have to go in there and pay for the new person another $100. So it can become a very high financial burden on the business to have to do that. I think that if, when the certification comes along, if you have the manager or the owner or whatever trained, they should be able to train the employees versus every single employee having to have it. You know, I think.
Oh, you're suggesting that having an option of training your own employees would be helpful.
I think that would be one of the best things that could be put in there to take the financial burden off of a small communities and also the larger ones. You know how employees, they come and go and come and go and come and go. I am right now, and like I spoke with you on the telephone, I'm getting less per TAM now than I was when I opened up in 1986 because people down here can't afford to pay higher and higher and higher. We're not on high wages. We don't have any big major industries. Walmart, they pay. My son's worked there for 14 years, and he's just now making $13 an hour, but he doesn't make enough to even get his own apartment and live in his own because then they cut back hours. But we don't have a lot of high-paying jobs in the smaller communities to be able to afford it, and it's going to put people out of business. I talked with several different, as soon as I got off the telephone with you, I started calling other salons all over the state, and one I heard has already closed in Juneau. Another one told me if this gets implemented, they're going to file Chapter 11 and go out of business. Is this what the state's in? Does the state really want to put people out of business? Because that's the financial strain it's going to put on people when you implement something like that. So I think it would be a good suggestion that we do train our people. I myself, as a small town person, I was born and raised here, I would be willing to train other people, and I wouldn't charge them a cent because I'm all about small business and making small businesses affordable. It's not like you go in for a CT scan down here in one little section. My husband went in and had two. It was $3,000 versus a tanning session that we get anywhere from $5 to maybe $8 a session. That's kind of ludicrous.
I hear your concerns, and I've made note of it. And if you wanted to put anything else in writing and get that to us, we will certainly consider that.
I've been working on it, and I've been having people sign it as a group. So,
thank you very much for your comments.
Hey, I thank you for all the time, and if you ever need to contact me, you can always call me. I think I gave you my number before.
Yes, we do have that.
So if you have my number, and if you ever need to contact me about anything, I'm here on the other end or whatever.
Thank you, Donna.
Okay, thank you, Clyde. And thank you for taking the time to allow me to speak.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Is there anyone else with questions or comments? Don, have you spoken with other cardiologists, by the way?
I've not had a real big chance to talk to all the cardiologists because this kind of hit me on Friday.
Oh.
Of course, Thursday, yeah. That's the first that we knew about it was on Thursday.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would encourage them. This is the only live public testimony period, but they have another month to get in fax, email, letters. They can call in, too, but it's better to have it in writing so that we have a clear idea of what you're saying.
I'll make sure that I present it to the Heart Institute so that the cardiologist can make comment as well.
And I've been very aware that that could be a sensitive area for cardiologists, and surprised I haven't heard anything.
I don't think they're aware of it collectively, and as they're practicing, you know, they're gonna, it's going to come to a point of time when we're going to have to tell them they can't perform procedures.
Yes.
And in retro, they're going to say why, and
yes. Well, and I understand, you know, the notices went out to all facilities in our database who were registered, other than the databases that didn't exist, such as the Tanning database, until we put it all together. So Providence got the notice, and so did the Providence Oncology Department. But that doesn't mean that cardiology, it depends on whether the manager passed it on. And tanning has been kind of interesting. It's an industry that one of the very first things that Obamacare did was hit them with a 10% tax on their income. Now, that's a huge bite for, you know, given that they had no tax on it before.
He doesn't want 10 people walking around. I don't get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the other thing is we generated the database from the business license list in Alaska, and then we went online to try to find places. And we received about 20% return on the mail apps, no longer at this address, out of business.
Wow.
So I think that federal tax, as of 2 years ago, has hit a lot of them really hard. So I can understand their concerns about the costs. Oh, yes. On page 24, I think it is. Oh, page 25. 7AC18.420, Instruction of Medical Radiation Device Operators. And then in part B, in bold print, it says you have to be registered or the equivalent. And then it also says, in a facility where ionizing radiation exposures to humans are confined to the thorax, vertebral, skeletal, column or appendicular skeleton, the department may approve an exemption.
Okay.
And that's what would be a...
I guess that's the scary part, is it's just kind of out there, you know, in the ether as far as defining that, you know. So what does get an exemption, what doesn't.
Right.
It seems to me it would make sense what the unit,
but
if it's properly calibrated and tested, years, like our regulations already require, if it's a certain level of dose,
mm-hmm,
you know, below a certain threshold, then it would maybe qualify for.
Well, that's a good point, something worth looking at. Just we want to be careful that somebody doesn't operate, you know, a few microsievert dose kind of device thinking that they can now operate something that has a much higher dose rate.
Right.
But we already have a precedence in terms of what has to be approved and what can just be operated immediately. So it's not a bad idea to look at it that way. Yes.
So, Don Allison again, when you're talking about certifying an operator,
yes,
are you talking? We're looking at someone that has a national registry, and the state's going to track those now, as well as the federal or the national registry.
Well, we can verify that.
Right.
Very easily.
Well,
I'm not sure what you're...
For example, in the state, I'm licensed as an X-ray tech in the state of Washington.
Okay.
And there they track, as long as I have a federal registry and I prove to them that I have my 24 continuing education units on,
mm-hmm,
a biennial basis, they will renew my my state licensure for a nominal fee. Is that essentially what the state of Alaska is looking at doing?
Well, it'll be similar, but we're not even going to look at your continuing ed because you don't have a current certificate if you haven't met the continuing ed requirements. So basically, by the fact that you have a credential that requires continuing ed, if you had that credential, then you must have the continuing ed. Otherwise, you wouldn't have the credential.
Is there going to be a fee associated with being a licensed operator in the state?
There's a permit fee.
But that's related to the units, right? The X-ray units?
Well, no. The registration fee is registering your device.
Right.
So if you have a CT scanner, you pay a fee to register that scanner. Now, if you're the operator, then you pay a fee to get a two-year permit, which on the ongoing basis is $45 for 2 years.
Okay. And
so that is a fee.
And that's going to go on the birth date biennium? Is that like the rest? Okay.
And it would be based on based on whenever you got the permit to start with.
And then we were talking about when for fluoroscopic exams, we talk about the 10-hour required safety course that everybody's supposed to attend.
That's fluoroscopy.
And you basically dropped and stated that the radiologists that have received all the training don't have to fall into that criteria.
Right.
But we have surgeons and podiatrists and vascular surgeons now that aren't radiologists that are operating fluoroscopic machines. They only have to attend that 10-hour class, and they would be considered an operator and would have to apply for a license?
Right.
Or is that?
Well, the regulations state that specifically that a licensed practitioner of the healing arts, which, by the way, this is a change. The current regulations say a licensed practitioner of the healing arts in Alaska is exempt, which would be a physician, a podiatrist, a chiropractor. I mean, it lists the specific professions that are included in that. They are exempt. They don't have to prove that they've had training, even though our information shows they don't normally get that training. But by virtue of their professional license, they're exempt. What's changed now in the proposed ones is to drop the in Alaska part. So if they're a licensed physician in Washington, even if they don't have an Alaska license, they would be exempt. If they come up here, they're visiting. They can operate the X-ray machine without having to have a permit. But the fluoroscopy does apply to anyone who is unable to document that they've had 10 hours specific training in medical fluoroscopy. So a cardiologist is in a kind of a gray area because they may very well have already received that 10 hours. If they can show that, then that's fine. And technically, a radiologist is not exempt. However, their board certification does require the equivalent of that. So they get in not because they're exempt, but because they can demonstrate by board certification that they've met that. Incidentally, that's not a license. The fluoroscopy permit is not a license.
Right.
Because a license, once you get that permit, you're done forever. There's no time limit. Then there's no fee for the permit.
Yeah, it's something that the hospital or the clinic that's running the fluoroscopy unit has to keep track of. I understand that.
Right. And the other thing is that there's no time frame listed in it. It doesn't say you need to get this every 2 years or whatever. So if you are a physician in Washington State, for example, in order to operate a fluoroscope, you have to meet their permit, fluoro permit requirement, and that applies to physicians too. So let's say you have a permit from California or from Washington. You come up to Alaska and your permit has expired. Well, our regulations don't say you have to have a current permit. You've already taken what exceeds the Alaska requirements if you ever had a permit in California. So you've met the requirements in Alaska.
They just have to prove that they took.
Right. You can show an expired permit and you've met the Alaska requirement. The Alaska requirement is pretty minimal. But we really were concerned about the safety when we were seeing more and more of the interventional injuries due to medical use of fluoroscopes, and that was the reason for putting that in.
So with your operator class, I know that the state offers for rural communities that don't have the ability to have a certified X-ray tech, they can have nurses trained through a certain state program to have certification to do X-rays. Is that still going to be in force with this, or is that going to go about the wayside?
You're talking about the course at ANMC?
That's
not a state. The reason for asking, that's not a state-sponsored program.
Okay.
That's a program that they run out of at ANMC.
The state accepts that as equivalent training.
Well, sort of. we have no reason to reject it. These proposed regulations require more training than that. It's not going to be a 24-month or 36-month national certification kind of thing, but you do need a little more substantial training than that. They only have like two days of theory, and the rest is on some positioning. It's better than nothing, but it still doesn't address certain things very thoroughly.
It doesn't give the radiation safety aspect.
No.
Yeah.
No. And incidentally, the person who spearheaded that for several years has just retired from NMC and has a contract with South Central to go around to different clinics and beef up their radiation safety. So he may actually expand on that and make a course available at individual institutions that would be more in line with what we're looking for a minimum. Thank you for your comment. And I see we have a call from BJ Anderson.
Hi, thank you, Clyde. This is BJ Anderson.
Yes,
and
BJ.
I would like to add public comment regarding the changes to 7AAC 18.420, instruction of medical radiation device operators.
Yes.
I'm concerned that the new regulations may generate unintended consequences to those facilities that are using personnel that have been trained on the job. And by the way, are you able to hear me okay?
Yes, we hear you fine.
Okay, just wanted to make sure. The new regulations specify the operator must be registered with ARRT or equivalent of a limited license. Therefore, what would happen to radiology services at those facilities who use personnel that are trained on the job?
Well, they would have to definitely have their knowledge evaluated. And there are a couple of ways of doing that, but my experience has been that many of those trained on the job have taken, for example, the Glacier Valley online program, which actually meets the requirements for the limited scope permit.
Does the state know how many operators in Alaska that these changes will affect?
We don't know positively. We think that it'll be about 500 people, but of course we don't register or in any way monitor personnel presently, so we don't have statistics that are based on a database. We can only base it on what we know about facilities in general.
So is there a timeline of implementation of this regulation change?
That depends on what happens following the public comment. Maybe you didn't hear earlier. We have until January 15th to receive public comment. Then after that, we need to address all the comments and questions. And if they're relatively minor, we can implement small changes and then put the regulations presented back and then it'll go to the governor's desk. That'll probably be March or April before they could possibly go. So that would be the short term as far as implementation. If the public comment results in substantial changes to it, we may have to go back to a public review again, which would move it back even further. So it depends on the comments and how much of a change is required in the proposed regulations as to when it goes into effect. I wouldn't expect it to happen in less than 6 months from now at the earliest.
Will there be a grandfather clause for staff that are currently working as trained on the job staff?
No. This is not a license, so there are some differences.
Well, it's a requirement. If you're requiring personnel to have some kind of license or proof of certification, then there needs to be a transition period. There needs to be perhaps a probationary period for individuals who are already working, trained on the job, in order to give them time to study and obtain the required training.
Yes. And that can be taken into account in determining when the actual regulations are implemented.
Yeah, that's why I asked that question about.
But that's not the same as saying, well, you've been doing it, so you can continue doing it, whether you've ever learned to do it right or not. So you're suggesting a probationary period in implementation of the qualifications.
Well, certainly. How much time does it take to go through the Glacier program and get a limited license?
Well, it's an online program. It's self-paced. So I would estimate in 1 month you could do it pretty easily. And since it is online, you can do it from home or after hours from work.
So I just think these things need to be taken into consideration. 500 individuals in this state who are operating without license that is in line with these regulations, they're going to have to do something.
I agree.
And so there needs to be a period of time to allow for a smooth transition so that our rural communities don't get shut down without services.
Well, we don't want to shut down vitally needed services, that's for sure.
So thank you for the opportunity to make these comments.
Thank you, BJ. If you wouldn't mind, you could also send your comments in written form by fax, email, or ordinary snail mail, which this time of year it's particularly emphasizing the snail part.
So are these comments being recorded, or do we need to also send them as written comments?
Well, they're being recorded. Everything that we say today is a matter of permanent public record. And I will need to sift through that, but it will make sure that you get heard if we also have some hard copy to look at.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do you have any other questions or comments?
I have a comment.
Yes.
I'm Tiffany Peterson. I work for a private clinic as an imaging manager, and I think one of the biggest concerns, I'm hearing all the concerns from other people, but I believe that the one thing that's being missed is the whole purpose of this is to decrease the amount of radiation to our patients and society, and I think that there's a lot of people out there that are just doing x-rays, don't realize body habitus changes, amount of radiation you're giving to the patient, especially now that we have new digital equipment. They think that's going to make the difference, and it does not. And I can tell you that from people having metal in their bodies, the doses are higher than what you would give somebody that is just general body habitus. So I want people to remember that this is a radiation dose, regardless of how small it is, whether it be a DEXA machine, a tanning salon, those kind of things, it's still radiation, and we're still giving it to our patients or our customers.
Yes. And that's the whole purpose of the regulations is having to do with radiation safety and keeping the dose ALARA. And if we don't do that, we have no reason to be making regulations at all. Thank you. Cold weather must have had an impact.
I think it's the construction across the street.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I came an hour early to be sure I could find the place, and I still didn't actually get in the building for only about a half hour ahead. then we are officially open until noon, so I'm here till noon. You can be as long as you like. Thank you. I appreciate you coming in. This is the whole thing. It's not like we're writing regulations and this is what you're going to have to live with. We need input.
That's right.
And you've all brought up some really good points.
I agree that we need more regulation, but I just don't see how, you know, the positions that have these units way out in the bush that don't have certified technologists, I don't, they're going to get very surprised in the near future.
Well, it's very interesting. I don't know if you've ever done a search on what doctors don't know related to radiation. There have been several surveys, and it's not just a U.S. problem. It's nationwide, or it's a worldwide. I mean, some of the studies are like Iran and Turkey, and there's a Dr. Shirokar in, I think it was England, was the one back in 2003, I think, kind of started this whole thing, and then they started doing surveys elsewhere. And they found out that doctors consistently significantly underestimate the exposure that patients get from various exams, and general family practitioners in particular, they were asking some simple questions. How much radiation does a patient get from a chest x-ray? Does ultrasound involve radiation? Does CT involve radiation? And they found like 9% of them knew the answer.
Right.
There's a significant...
I have one other comment.
Yes.
This is Matt Halala again. In reference to that, it's interesting. We have different degree programs, of course, in our country of people that use x-ray technology,
right,
or whatever. The dentist, the podiatrist, the doctor of osteopathy, and the MD.
Yes.
And as a part of our degree program,
yes,
Doctor of Podiatric Medicine, we take 16 semester credit hours in radiology and x-ray technology as a part of our degree.
Yes.
And that's because we know up front what we're going to be doing in practice.
Yes.
And the traditional allopathic route has not included those courses because they've got the tradition of divvying up the specialties into the world of radiology as something you do after your degree program to become a radiologist.
Yeah.
So why would you have students getting an MD degree taking x-ray technology and safety courses? So is the reasoning.
Right, right.
But I think what's been occurring, of course, is
the
new modalities in cardiology and all these are now having use for x-ray imaging for their new, you know, these different, catheterizations and things. And so I think the application of x-ray technologies and modalities is kind of spreading out into the specialties. So I think it needs to be recognized, and this is why we were exempted from that 10-hour course at Providence and Regional, the podiatrists, because as a part of our degree, we had to prove all of those semester credit hours in x-ray technology and safety and as part of our degree, our baseline.
Well, the 10 is specifically fluoroscopy safety.
Right, and that's all included, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that is an interesting little... Well, exactly right.
Right.
But that's something else that's a little nuance that we hope isn't forgotten, too.
Right.
You know, that the different degree programs and exactly what doctors don't know, it's probably not that surprising when you look at the traditional allopathic or the DO route from right out of school, if they didn't have any coursework in that.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
right.
It's not surprising.
The traditional view is when you are licensed to practice medicine, you're licensed to practice it in all of its various aspects, which assumes then you can operate an x-ray machine and you know all about it. But we have plenty of evidence that the physicians in general don't know, and part of it was a testimony to Tom Anderson's committee back in 2006, where the president of the Alaska, I think it was called the Academy of Physician Assistants, and the Alaska Medical Society got up and flat out said, "We don't know. We don't know how to do that."
Right.
Well, I'm not surprised because before I came to Alaska, I worked for a health physics consulting company and traveled all over the U.S. training physicians in basic radiation safety because they didn't know. And we would use a pretest and a post-test to be able to demonstrate that they had learned, and nobody ever passed the pretest in basic radiation safety. They did by the end of the course. But
okay.
Thank you.
Hard enough to get on the word of their legs.
Yeah. Thank you. Let's see. Donna Ruffsholm. I understand Donna Ruffsholm is on this.
Yes. Hi, Clyde. Yes, I am.
Hi.
I'd like to testify in support of the regulatory changes that are being discussed today. I think that the changes are one action that can be taken to ensure that patients and the operators of imaging equipment are not exposed to avoidable radiation because it establishes education and credentialing standards for these individuals. Using fully competent individuals to perform procedures and X-ray procedures is critical, I think, in the state of Alaska to provide the safest and best care to citizens in Alaska. These regulations address the educational credentialing requirements, something that we don't have in place today, and the quality of any medical procedure is directly linked to the skill and the competence of the individual performing it. And we all know that if we have a surgeon perform a surgery on us, we want the best and most competent individual doing that, someone who's had the proper training. And it's the same for X-ray procedures. The errors can cause devastating side effects, something that I wouldn't want to subject myself or my family or my friends to unnecessarily. But it's happening in the state of Alaska today with X-ray. I know what facilities to go to, and I know who uses competent and educated staff, and I use these facilities and steer my friends to them, but not everyone is so fortunate. A lot of people do not know who work in the facilities. They assume that because an individual is working in a medical office or a medical facility, they know what they're doing. Because they're working there, because they wear that white coat. But in many in situations, the assumption is incorrect. The individual who's taken the X-ray may have had no training at all. And I don't know, I just came into the teleconference. I'm sorry, I'm logging a little bit late, and this may have already been discussed about the possible or the actually known hazards of X-ray. They're classified as a carcinogen by the World Health Organization, the CDC, and the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. But in the state of Alaska, virtually anyone can expose humans to radiation without any formal training. And the unsafe practice in Alaska is compounded by the higher exposures associated with the technologies that we're using today. People don't know, the operators don't know, that they're putting themselves at risk as well as their patients because they don't have the training or the education that would enable them to be aware of it, to educate them of it. So I totally support the proposed regulation changes, the draft changes, and wanted to let individuals know that there are other people out there as well who support these changes who weren't able to be at the teleconference today.
Thank you very much. Do you have any questions or just wanted to make your comments?
Just make my comment. Thank you.
We appreciate it. Then we have Roberta Shields from Ketchikan. Oh. Okay. Not sure what that was about, but it's X-rays or tanning or whatever. Don, would you have a problem with the change in the proposed change in the fetal dose from 500 to 100 mR. That's based on the general public being limited to 100 mR over a year and the fetus being unable to have any control over what it's exposed to.
No. The question that I would propose is follow-on caveat to that is when you're talking about the female as she's because it's a voluntary thing.
Yes.
You kind of split two hairs there. One says if they notify you that they're pregnant at the beginning of the term of the pregnancy, you get 100 millirem. But somewhere downstream after, you know, month, 2 months, 3 months, whatever, they get to the point where they want to declare the pregnancy, then there's a different rule. I
Well, excuse me. The problem is you cannot require a person to declare pregnancy under privacy laws. But once they do declare, then you have to prove that the baby over the past whatever number of months have transferred by, you have to prove the baby did not exceed that. So if they tell you at month 7 that they're pregnant, which you already well tell, you have to go back to the beginning and look at their dose, and hopefully their dose didn't vary considerably from month to month, which can make it tricky. But, of course, even a technologist who has exposures that are approaching the occupational limit, generally the fetal dose is such a small portion of that. Plus the fact that the personnel badge is outside the apron, whereas once they declare, you can start measuring under the apron. But what happens under the apron is a lot different than the official whole-body dose from outside the apron. So there's quite a bit of difference between the recorded exposure dose.
It's confusing trying to read it, because I read it in, like, you declare your pregnancy 3 months down the line, then we adjust your dose rate so that you can get up to 500 millirem over the term of the pregnancy versus the 100. It didn't make any sense how it was written. At least I hadn't read through it hard enough to make it come to a conscious.
So in the proposed reg, you're saying it's unclear how you applied that?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we may take another look at that then.
Since I was just skimming over it,
right. The regulation is stating the maximum dose the baby can get, and so you need to track how much exposure the baby's had. The problem comes in that you may not officially know the pregnancy's there until I need tomorrow off because I'm going to have a baby. And that makes it challenging then to go back and look over their exposure records 9 months back. But you can't assume, although if it becomes evident to you, you can just start monitoring under the apron just because you want to have a more complete monitoring process. But it's not like once it's identified, then you have from there to the end of pregnancy. The dose limit has to do with during the entire pregnancy, did the fetus receive more than this amount of exposure?
I'm sure there have been people that have tested it the other way and didn't declare their pregnancy until the baby was born, birth announcement.
Right. Yes. Well, and there's a personal question. Maybe they don't want anybody to know. And that's their right. Yes.
If we can prove over historical data that people involved in surgical procedures involving C-arm fluoroscopy do not receive exposure from the procedure, can we get can we go by that?
Yeah.
Because we're also looking at the requirement to badge somebody only being if they exceed 100 millirem in a year. So if I can prove over a period of time nobody in these fluoroscopy procedures has been exposed to 100 millirem, can we get out of the requirement of badging?
Well, the requirement to badge in general is if you're likely to get one-tenth of the annual limit. So if you're not likely to get one-tenth of the annual limit, the badge is not required. But then there is that separate part that says if you're operating a mobile fluoroscope, for example, then you are required to have a badge and a lead apron. But if you could demonstrate that they're not getting the radiation, I'm not sure how you would demonstrate that without a badge.
Well, we've badged individuals in the past.
Yeah.
And statistically, we can show that everybody that's been involved with those procedures has not, and we have not been badging our surgical entities longer at a time because of that. We can prove that over time.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way I would look at that is if you had a case that went to court, would you be able to prove you have a female employee who has a baby and there's something wrong with the baby, so she sues your facility saying you guys exposed me to too much radiation in my job. Are you on solid ground proving that you did not? I mean, that's just one aspect of looking at it. Yep, that's a written comment.
It's not a written comment. It was just information that our physician had that talks about specific to the CT scanner.
Oh, yes.
The dosage.
Oh, I can take it now. Sure. Great. Thank you. Oh, great. PEDCAT. Yeah, the newer technologies certainly do complicate things. We're getting more and more technology that it's kind of, for example, a traditional rule is you're not allowed to hold the X-ray tube when you're doing an exam because there's no X-ray tube that is 100% shielded. There's always the definition of a diagnostic X-ray tube is based on how much radiation leaks at 1 meter, 100 MR. So if you're holding an X-ray tube, and it has leakage that doesn't exceed the limit, you could be getting quite a bit of dose. So now they have a company that sells handheld X-ray machines. So those things have to be, and then FDA has found versions of the handheld X-ray device from China that are not safe. So how many people are getting those, and they seem to be contrary to the regulations to begin with. So all of those, pardon me, yes, and they have a little circular shield on the front of it. And so in their pictures, they show the person holding that, and the shield then prevents the X-rays from getting down to the eye level or the gonads. But it never shows you've tilted it, and then you're exposing the gonads, or you tilt it this way, you're exposing the eye lens. It never shows that particular picture. So they do have to have some extra considerations on how it's used. Homing CT, and of course, is also not evaluated, but that's all under dentistry. Well, we have 35 more minutes. Pardon me?
Oh, I was saying, the minute you leave,
yeah. All right. You know, I have to hang in here just in case. Yes.
And it's just the sheer number of bodies that still prevents us from doing that?
Yeah, employees. One of the big things is we expect that this will generate enough revenue that we have the position still open for a health physicist that we've never been able to hire because the state says we don't have the money. Well, I'm not going to be doing this forever. I have no specific plans for retirement, but I'm getting close. And we need two people at least. And
what
if for
the minimum criteria?
Well, we need one full-time person who would do only materials. And if we charge the rates that the NRC did, given the amount of licensees, we could actually generate the revenue to have the program. But we never did. We actually didn't even charge any fees. The NRC rates, as you know, are not cheap. And they charge you to register or to license your materials. They charge you for inspection. They charge you for follow-up. They charge for anything. The NRC has a full cost recovery approach. Whatever it costs for the program is what you get charged. You as a, you know, a body of licensees.
Yeah. You pay $8,000 a year.
Yeah. Yeah. Fortunately, most of the licensees that we had under the state program already had an NRC license, too, because NRC handled byproduct materials and the state handled the accelerator-produced materials. So they already had an NRC license plus registered with the state. So when we dropped it and the NRC took over the whole thing, it probably didn't show much difference in their costs. But some facilities had only accelerator-produced materials, so when they had to go to NRC, that was a big hit. Well, I think we'd be better off having an agreement state and have everything handled at the state level. Alaska is unique, and I'm not suggesting that we water down the regulation. We have to be consistent with NRC anyway, but there are reasons that it would be a good idea to have as an agreement state. But we have to have a minimum of one person full-time dealing with materials and nothing else. Well, we don't have that. We don't have that possibility. Yeah, we have two people, and if all of this goes through, we're going to need two people and more to do everything. But I've never been under the illusion that my job is secure, that they can't drop me in a minute in spite of the fact that I'm the only one. They've had this program with nobody in it for a period of time, long before I started.
So you haven't expected for a position to be released once this is done?
Oh, yeah. One of the first things we're going to do is get that position filled.
Is it difficult to find someone who meets the criteria to be able to do the job, or just getting someone to come to Alaska or a person in Alaska to fill the position?
It has to do with the state salary schedule. It's set up by the state. This is what we can offer. And a health physicist right out of school can start with a six-figure income most anywhere. And we can't approach that.
Yeah.
And their perception is that living in Alaska is a lot more expensive. So we have to be higher, pay higher than average, and we don't pay anywhere near that amount. So we get, you know, we've advertised in the past, and they would, one of the comments, well, is this a part-time job? No, that's what it pays. And a couple people I know of, they really wanted to come to Alaska. They like hunting and fishing. They really want to come up here, but not for nothing.
And the state probably doesn't have a relocation.
No, there's a specific pay scale that we have to go by for that position. We had it reevaluated. They nudged it up a little bit. So it's going to be interesting to see if we can get anybody. Depends on how the job market is. There still is a critical manpower shortage for health physicists nationwide. So they have choices. They don't have to come here.
Yeah.
It's not as desperate as other occupations. Yeah.
And then you need to fill the position, and say 6 months goes by and the position is not filled, then what would happen?
Well, we do. Exactly. I do what I can do now, and I can only do so much. You know, most places you have one person, or well, not one, but you have inspectors for radioactive materials. Of course, you have a management person. You have X-ray machines. You have somebody else that does shielding design. You have somebody else that does the permitting. Different people or multiple people in all these sections. Well, in Alaska, it's one person doing everything. When I'm in my office, I'm not out there doing inspections, which I'm supposed to be doing. So when I'm out there doing inspections, there's nobody in the office. So I'm always not doing something.
So with your shielding designs, if we submit with a physicist, have them do shielding designs and then just submit that to you?
Right.
That you're going to charge your $250, whatever it is, to review that, but that's going to be...
Right. So I've done that on occasion when they say they don't have any resources. But we put that fee in there now to try and encourage them to just, I mean, if you go to Corin or Northwest Health Physics and they do it, they're certified health physicists, we're just going to approve it. I'm not going to try to redo all the calculations. I mean, you've got a qualified person that did the shielding design. Okay, it's approved. But if you send it to me, then I have to do all that work, and it's time-consuming. So we want to charge you enough of a fee that it's faster and just as cheap to get somebody else to do it. Faster because I may not be in the office for a week or so. I just got back from a week in Chicago.
Personally?
Yep. That's a great meeting. 70,000 people from all over the world come to that meeting.
Yeah.
And there are always all kinds of new things. It's a great source of information. Plus, opportunities to get continuing ed from renewing your credentials.
You have a state pay for those kind of trips for you, though, don't you?
Sometimes. This year they did. I've gone before when they would not pay it. It's not cheap, but it's important enough I paid out of my pocket to go.
I haven't gone to one yet, so.
No, it's great. You should at least go to one. All right.
I'll pay for her.
Well, I know some managers in the state that go every year, and because it's that important, especially if you're thinking of buying new equipment, you want to get a new scanner, you can see different companies, you get information from a whole bunch of companies right there, and you can talk to them face to face and get answers to your questions. Really, it's great.
I know the purpose of the hunt is I've just not
yeah.
anybody want to buy me a new piece of equipment.
Right. All right.
Thank you
very much, and thank you for that paperwork.
Yes.
I guess I'm going to leave you alone.
All right. Well, I'm used to being alone.
So I really am interested in looking into a state position and when I'm going to come up. So
yeah.
I'll want you to have a position description in mind. I'll try to find it online.
Oh, yeah. What is it called? Alaska? Huh.
I had to go through a website and get a secure password and a whole bunch of other things.
Oh. I don't know why I'm drawing a blank. Well, I've been sick. If this had happened on last Friday, there's no way I would be here. Anyway, there is an Alaska State Jobs website.
Yeah.
And they have the job description there.
I think it'd be pretty good for material.
Yeah. Oh, I would love to see us have a become an agreement state. Handle it locally. Yeah. Because now if we have an incident, NRC has to come up, and we're paying for that.
A state pays for that?
Yeah, we have to pay the NRC.
It wouldn't be the site?
Well, it depends. Sometimes you get like an orphan source and where did it come from? Nobody claims knowledge of it.
Yeah. So what does the state have access to as far as radiation monitoring? Do you have a stock?
Well, we still have all of it.
You would use the Air Force, the Army.
Well, yeah, CST could be involved in a radiological response incident, but we still have all our instrumentation from before, and we have a GR-130 for differentiating nuclides, identifying particular nuclides, and then we have a sodium iodide well counter for counting samples, and I use that with some samples we got off of Montague Island, Craig, and Kodiak, looking for contamination from Japan.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we have GM-type survey meters. So we can still do quite a bit, and we're still involved. I get calls all the time still about Japan and whether the fish is safe to eat. And that's a very interesting thing. I met with somebody about the results of some fish and other sea samples taken off M. Chitka that were analyzed at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. And they were showing the risk from these various samples, and very low. But there was one there that this person was remarking on, 10 to the minus 4th, that's just not acceptable. That means one in 10,000. And during the discussion, this person bent over to pick up their pen that had dropped, and their cigarettes fell out of their pocket. The risk of getting cancer from cigarette smoking is much higher than one out of 10,000. So it's interesting perception. And then 4 picocuries per kilogram of cesium in a tuna. And I use the example, you do a bone scan, you're using 20 millicuries now?
For a bone scan?
Yeah.
25.
25, okay. Yeah. So 25 millicuries is 25,000 microcuries, which is 25 million nanocuries, which is 25 billion picocuries, divided by 4. So you're talking about 6 billion times the activity. Now, of course, technetium is not the same as cesium. But if you're just worried about activity, 6 billion times as much as used in an ordinary diagnostic study that is not considered unsafe or dangerous. 6 billion times as much as what's in that little tuna. Right. We can't even measure to that level. But people are very worried about it.
Well, you can measure, but you have to do a real long count of the...
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll talk to you later.
Thank you for coming.
No problem. And my arm twisted.
Oh, yeah. You too. It's 12 o'clock noon. This concludes the time for verbal testimony. If anyone is out there and would still like to submit comments, we encourage you to do so by either sending an email or a fax or sending a written letter to the Department of Health and Social Services at the address, phone number, or fax number, or email address that was in the original announcement. And we thank all of you who participated, and we will definitely take your comments into account in finalizing the proposal. Thank you very much. Good day.